understand colonial America, we need to understand the intensity of the colonial impulse to be free. Freedom was a much-used word that swept in more than just political independence from England. It included cultural freedom from Europe. America's first notable poet, Joel Barlow, repeatedly asserted our cultural independence. He brashly called America a theater for the display of merit of every kind. Sometimes this impulse toward freedom was downright arrogant, a typical anonymous Revolutionary War song set to the skirl of fife and drum ends with the lines, "And we'll march up the heavenly streets and ground our arms at Jesus' feet." Other times it resulted in gentler expressions of the same sentiment. Francis Hopkinson gave us a widely sung lilting melody with the title, "My Days Have Been So Wondrous Free." But always present was a direct, innocent, homemade, and somehow completely engaging quality that captures our imagination. It was strong, affecting, and wonderfully amateur. Benjamin Franklin had been laying the groundwork. One letter in his book on electricity was written in 1761 from Ben to his brother Peter. Peter had sent a ballad he'd written. Franklin writes back from England, where he was serving as a colonial representative. He looks at the homespun sentiments of the ballad and he says, "If you had given it to some country girl in Massachusetts who has never heard any other than psalm tunes or ditties like Chevy Chase, but has a naturally good ear, she might more probably have made a pleasing popular tune for you than any of our masters here." That's a swipe at the great Baroque composers around him. He doesn't like what they're up to. He says, "The reigning taste seems to be quite out of nature, or rather, the reverse of nature." Franklin strongly objects to the way they set words to music. He encloses an aria from Handel's oratorio, Judas Maccabeus, and he uses it to demonstrate that text settings are becoming dysfunctional. Accents, he says, are often in the wrong place. He objects to what he calls drawling and stuttering, drawing words out on tied-over notes and fragmenting them with elaborate trills or other ornaments. He objects to placing words so they're unintelligible. He objects to the tautology of words needlessly repeated. A century later, Tennyson would also complain that "musicians always make me say twice what I would say only once." The last item in Franklin's list is screaming without cause. So, how are we to view this? I've sung a lot of Handel's music myself, and I rather like the way he sets words. But I was raised on Handel. Franklin was honing a vision of a nation run by hard-working citizens, and they don't do music like this. Franklin was defining music for this new world. It should be a tuneful but straightforward vehicle for text. He returns to that point in a postscript that any good singer will certainly heed today. He finds that many leading British singers are lazy about consonants. Their singing isn't about words, he complains. It's only about showing off their vocal technique. I don't know that composer William Billings had read Franklin's letter, but his music certainly reflects its sentiments. Billings was born in Boston in 1747. He was poor and uneducated. He supported himself much of the time as a tanner. But he also took up music when he was young. He was teaching choral singing by the age of 22, in the same year Franklin's letter was published. Billings is the best-known colonial American composer, yet few sophisticated musicians think much of him. I love his stuff. His biographers call him a gargoyle. He was blind in one eye with a short leg and a withered arm. But the real problem was his practice of what a contemporary called an uncommon negligence of person. He was hopelessly addicted to tobacco, constantly inhaling handfuls of snuff. That may explain why he lived only to the age of 54. He had a stentorian, tobacco-damaged bass voice, and he seemed uninterested in any easy beauty of sound. He was only 24 when he published his first book of choral pieces. He called it The New England Psalm Singer, and Paul Revere engraved the frontispiece for it. He went on to publish 5 more volumes, as well as a good deal of sheet music. The New England Psalm Singer was the first book of American music. It began a tradition of musical grassroots choral singing in America, and Billings knew what he'd done. He delayed publication over a year until he could print it on paper made in the colonies. No British imports for Billings. As a result, the paper is a dirty gray in color, but in the book we find the song Chester, which rivaled Yankee Doodle as our anthem of revolution. Let tyrants shake their iron rod and slavery clank her galling chains. We fear them not, we trust in God. New England's God forever reigns. One remark that Ben Franklin had made was that art would flow to the West, to the new American Athens. What he got was Billings' grand idiosyncratic music, no cultural continuity with anything. Billings' music emerged in the classical rationalist age with no trace of classical elegance. It really is an artistic declaration of independence. To know Billings, one should do more than just hear him. One should sing him. Four square, almost medieval harmonies, elaborate fugues, experiments with dissonance that foreshadow Charles Ives. He plays musical jokes, he praises God, and he dances into the erotic wonder of the Song of Solomon. Then he turns around and leaves us with one of the most exquisite short canons we've ever heard. When Jesus wept, the falling tear in mercy flowed beyond all bound. The essential genius of America and of Billings was recognizing that full independence of Europe would eventually be gained only after we'd formed our own cultural roots. And I am back to that letter from Franklin to his brother. Franklin offers an analogy. Wigs, he says, were invented to replace missing hair, but they've turned into something with no relation to natural hair. The wigs of the wealthy are patently false. So it is, he says, with European music. Years later, a much older Franklin turned up in France representing our new nation. He brought along his glass harmonica, and he appeared in the salons flaunting his unwigged, balding head. By then, Franklin's egalitarian ideas were no longer just ideas. The straightforward, tuneful, wigless country that he'd worked to create was now a reality. Billings' music embodied and defined that spirit, that country, just as perfectly as Ben Franklin himself had done.